Chapter 22 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 22. During the last 3 months of his imprisonment, Oscar Wilde wrote the letter to me which constitutes the whole of the book called De Profundis, and the unpublished part, which is in the British Museum. I never saw it, or had the slightest knowledge of it, till more than 12 years later, and to this day I do not know whether Wilde really meant what he said, or whether he merely wrote it and then thought better of it. According to the account given by Robert Ross in one of his prefaces, Wilde gave him the manuscript on the day he left prison. In another place, Ross implies that it was sent to him by Wilde while he was still in prison, with instructions as to what he was to do with it. The two stories appear to be contradictory. Quite apart from what he did to me, which is related in Chapter 7 of this book, Ross is shown by Frank Harris in the new preface to The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde to have been a truly monumental liar. His lies, like Falstaff's, were gross and palpable. Harris points out that the account he gives in his Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde of the death of Oscar, as related to him by Ross, is a pure invention of Ross's. Reggie Turner, who was in the room when Wilde died, has assured Harris that the account given by Ross, with its nauseating and disgusting details, is a lie from beginning to end. The same applies to Ross's account of the transference of Wilde's body to the Père Lachaise Cemetery. I refer my readers to the new preface, where they can read Harris's own account of these amazing perversions of fact, which were Ross's contribution to Harris's original book. Knowing, therefore, that Ross's testimony on this, as on any subject, is utterly valueless, it is impossible for me to arrive at any certain conclusion about the matter. I am not on speaking terms with any of Ross's intimate friends. If I were, I would endeavour to find out the truth from them, supposing that they know it. Oscar Wilde's surviving son, Vivian, whom I have not seen since he was a little boy of 7 or 8 years, possibly knows the real truth, if he has not been deceived by Ross, which is quite on the cards. At the time when I wrote my book, Oscar Wilde and myself, in collaboration with Crossland, just after the ransom case, I accepted Ross's story that Wilde was privy to the plot of keeping his attack on me secret and publishing it after my death. Now, however, I very much doubt the truth of this. I think it is quite possible that Wilde wrote the letter and thus purged his bosom of his rancour and unreasonable fury against my entirely innocent self, that he gave the letter to Ross when he came out of prison, telling him to send it on to me, or possibly telling him to keep it back for the time being. It seems difficult to believe that, having taken the trouble to write the letter of over 60,000 words, he deliberately refrained from giving me the opportunity to read it, which is apparently what Ross would have us believe. That then, when he made friends with me again, as he did within 3 weeks of his release from prison, he put the thing out of his mind and thought no more about it. As it contained what he no doubt regarded as a lot of fine writing, his author's vanity would have prevented him from irrevocably destroying it, and he may have had a vague intention of rewriting or revising it. It thus remained in Ross's hands, and when Oscar died, Ross had it, and was free to do what he liked with it, and to tell any story he pleased, there being no one who was in a position to contradict him, as to Wilde's instructions and intentions about it. It is surely significant that nowhere and at no time has Ross ever stated publicly and definitely that Wilde told him to keep the manuscript and conceal its existence from me. Ross left this to be inferred, but there is no record, as far as I know, of his ever having put it into actual words. Harris points out in the new preface to The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde that Oscar, after he came out of prison, consistently behaved in a double-faced way about me. He wrote me a quantity of letters from Berneval during the first 3 months after his release from prison, and before he met me again, in which he addressed me in the most affectionate terms. At the very time he was thus writing to me, calling me my own darling boy, and so forth, he was, as I only found out years afterwards, writing Ross abusive letters about me. Later, when he was taking large sums of money from me in Paris, he went about telling various people, everyone he met apparently, that I had not given him a penny and that I refused to help him. As Harris says, such falseness and treachery are hard even to understand, but the facts remain. In view of all these facts, and the utter unreliability as witnesses of both Ross and of Wilde himself, I do not see how it is possible that the real truth as to the De Profundis business can ever be known this side of the Day of Judgment. All I can say is that it is permissible to hope and believe that Wilde did not ultimately intend that his frantic abuse and his ignoble laments about the money he had spent on entertaining me to lunch and dinner in the days of his prosperity should be published after my death. It is even possible to take it for granted that as soon as he made friends with me again, he was heartily ashamed of what he had written. My own evidence on this point is obscured by the fact that, as I did not know of the existence of the De Profundis manuscript till years after Wilde's death, I may have missed references to it, which perhaps he made under the impression that I knew of its existence. He may have believed that Ross had actually sent it on to me, and he may have thought that I had duly received it, or that my silence about it was deliberate and calculated. That he did have some such idea is suggested by the fact, which I have recorded in Oscar Wilde and myself, that on one occasion when we were together he referred to something he had said or written about me in prison. Ross, while Wilde was in prison, had sent me a letter containing extracts from remarks which he alleged that Wilde had made about me. But whether these remarks had been written or merely repeated by word of mouth, I did not gather, because, as soon as I realised the nature of Ross's letter, which was a very long one of many pages, I tore it to pieces in a rage and hurled the fragments into the River Marne, by whose banks I was living at the time. It is quite possible that this letter of Ross's contained extracts from Wilde's De Profundis letter to me. On the other hand, if Ross's story that Wilde gave him the letter for the first time on the day he left prison is true, his letter to me, which reached me at Nogent-sur-Marne sometime before Wilde's release, could not possibly have contained any such extracts. All I can say with certainty is that on one occasion after I met Oscar again, after his release from prison, I reproached him about something or other in the course of a discussion we had, and he said words to the following effect. "Surely you are not bringing up against me what I wrote in prison when I was starving and half mad. You must know that I didn't really mean a word of what I said." It immediately, and naturally, occurred to me that he was referring to this letter of Ross's which was supposed to have contained extracts of things he had said, or written against me in prison, and I replied to the effect that I had really not done more than glance at the letter, and that as soon as I saw what it was about, I tore it into pieces and threw the pieces away, and determined to put the letter altogether out of my mind. As things are at present, and putting all the evidence together in my mind, I am very much inclined to think that he never intended the letter to be used against me, and that Ross had deliberately misrepresented Oscar's attitude and intentions about the letter. If this is the case, it relieves Oscar Wilde of what is otherwise the blackest and most terrible charge that was ever brought against him. It was the belief, shared at that time by myself, and I suppose by everyone who heard the evidence at the ransom trial, that Wilde had really been guilty of this dastardly treachery and ingratitude, which inspired Crossland to write his terrible and astonishingly brilliant indictment of Wilde called The First Stone. If Oscar has been wronged, all I can say is that he owes it to his evil genius, Robert Ross. By the time I started to write this book, I had pretty well convinced myself that Wilde was not guilty in this respect, and it is this feeling, which does not, however, altogether amount to one of certainty, that has enabled me to cut out of my heart the sentiments of anger, resentment, and indignation which inspired me at the time when, with Crossland's assistance, I wrote Oscar Wilde and myself in 1914. Having once arrived at this state of mind, it seems to me that I am bound to put it formally on record that I withdraw what I said about Oscar in that book. What I said does not, on the whole, represent the real truth, either about the facts of our friendship or my feelings for him. The whole book is distorted and wrenched out of focus by the bewildered resentment and indignation which overcame me when I first read the unpublished portion of De Profundis in the year 1913 or 1912. The ransom case was tried in 1913, but the plea of justification, including a copy of the unpublished portion of De Profundis, was, I believe, delivered at the end of 1912. What happened when I began to write that book was that Crossland, with whom I was then in close association, arising out of the fact that he had been my assistant editor on the Academy for more than 2 years, said to me, "You will never write this book as it ought to be written. Even now, after all that has happened, and after you have got the complete proof of what an unspeakable swine Wilde was, you are still too soft about him to put it right across him as you ought to do. Let me do that part of the book. In fact, you had much better let me write the book altogether, you, of course, giving me the facts and revising it after I've put them into shape." In the end, after much discussion, I agreed to let Crossland collaborate. I paid him handsomely, giving him half of all I got for the book, although originally he asked only for £100. I gave him at least £250. On several occasions, when I had written what I thought was a fairly scathing piece of criticism, Crossland would say, "Yes, it's all very fine and most admirably written, but you are still much too soft." He would then pace up and down the room and dictate, he nearly always dictated, a revised version of what I had written. In the end, the book was really more his than mine. He certainly said things about Wilde which I would never have thought of saying myself. But once they were written, I adopted them con amore. Crossland said, "What we must do is to knock this man clean off the pedestal on which his worshippers have erected him." A lot that the book contains is unfair and misleading. I hope I have learnt now, once for all, that it is always a mistake to be unfair, even to persons who are grossly unfair to oneself. The fact that Ross and Harris and others have deliberately invented and circulated malicious lies about me, and that Wilde himself spent 3 months of his life in prison in a crafty and cunning attempt to blacken my character by means of gross and brutal misrepresentations, does not justify me in hitting back as I did, by deliberately painting, and allowing Crossland to paint, a blacker and more biting portrait of the man than the truth warrants. In Oscar Wilde and Myself, I not only ran down Wilde unfairly, even to the extent of belittling some of his literary work, which I place very much higher than I have there allowed, but I entirely misrepresented the strength of my own love and devotion for him, which persisted right up to the time when I read the unpublished De Profundis in 1913. In doing this, I did less than justice to myself, because the only explanation of much of my conduct in regard to him is precisely that I really was, as I said once, in one of my cases, in the witness box, crazy about the man. The truth is that I really adored him, I think it is fairly certain that in spite of all his protestations about his wonderful love for me, I really loved him far more than he loved me. His love for me, even allowing for the undoubted fact that pain and suffering did, for a time, transfigure it and touch it to finer issues, was yet chiefly founded on his mere admiration for what he chose to consider my personal beauty. I am sorry to have to say it, but I cannot but feel that the explanation of the shocking way he behaved to me and about me during the last 2 or 3 years of his life after he came out of prison was simply that I was no longer quite so attractive in appearance as when he first met me. There is a passage in Dorian Gray which gives quite plainly his own views on this point. Lord Henry says to Basil Hallward, I quote from memory, for I have not read Dorian Gray for more than 12 years, "One day you will look at your friend and observe that his nose is a little out of drawing. You will resent it bitterly and feel that he has behaved very badly to you." On the other hand, whatever devotion I had for Oscar was certainly, and surely I may say quite obviously, not founded on any physical admiration of mine for him. I loved him because he was brilliant and wonderful and fantastic and fascinating in his mind and in his conversation. His personal appearance, at any rate while I knew him, was always rather against him. When I first met him, I thought him comic-looking. Afterwards, I got used to his strange aspect, and my admiration for his brain and the dazzling brilliance and spell-weaving enchantment of his conversation completely outweighed in my eyes the disadvantages of his appearance. When he got into his frightful trouble, my love for him was deeply intensified by pity and compassion. There was nothing I would not have done for him. It is a mere commonplace of truth to say that I would gladly have died for him, or gone to prison in his stead. That I am not now exaggerating the strength of the feeling I had for Oscar is easy enough to prove. I quote over Leaf a sonnet that I wrote about him after he had been dead nearly 3 years. As evidence of the quality and enduring nature of my devotion to him, it is overwhelming to anyone who can appreciate real and sincere poetry. Frank Harris is my great traducer, the man who has done more than anyone else to blacken me and calumniate me in the eyes of the whole world. He claims to have sold 40,000 copies of his abominable book, The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, in America. And, after admitting in writing that practically every word about me in that book is a deliberate lie or misrepresentation, after apologising and expressing his deep regret and his desire to atone for the grievous wrong he has done me, he has broken his promise to incorporate the new preface in future editions of his book, and to put footnotes to the book explaining that the misstatements about me were, as he says, insinuated into the book by Robert Ross, and he has brought out a new edition of his book, published by Brentano in New York, in which every single one of his lying statements about myself is repeated. He does not so much as mention the new preface containing his retraction, and if I had not brought it out myself, on my own responsibility, and after being advised by my solicitors that I was entitled to publish it because it is a retraction of and apology for a series of gross libels, it would never have seen the light at all. Yet, by a strange irony, this same Frank Harris is the only now living really prominent man of letters who has written enthusiastically about my poetry. Harris, in the new preface to The Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, after saying that as a writer of sonnets I can stand with Shakespeare, quotes the sonnet in question as an example of a poem which is as fine as anything that can be found in the whole treasure house of English poetry. Here it is, and let it end this chapter. Alas, that time should war against distress, and numb the sweet ache of remembered loss, and give for sorrow's gall to the indifferent dross of calm regret or stark forgetfulness. I should have worn eternal mourning dress, and nailed my soul to some perennial cross, and made my thoughts like restless waves that toss on the wild sea's intemperate wilderness. But lo, came life, and with its painted toys lured me to play again like any child. Oh, pardon me this weak inconstancy. May my soul die if in all present joys, lapped in forgetfulness or sense beguiled, yea, in my mirth, if I prefer not thee. End of chapter 22.